Hello, do you like New Japan Pro Wrestling? Are you a Shin Nihon freak? If so, check out the Super J-Cast with Joel and Damon on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.
And even if you fucking hate New Japan Pro Wrestling, listen to the Super J-Cast anyway. Not just for our great show reviews, analysis, and pastrami sandwiches, but there's also usually some dick jokes somewhere in the obligatory opening 30 minutes of absolute nonsense we chat about every single week. That's the Super J-Cast for all the best talk about New Japan Pro Wrestling, crisps, and pornography.
This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Welcome back to Those Days, a retrospective of Michinoku Pro Wrestling. Episode 4, Michinoku Takes Tokyo. Those Days is brought to you by the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network, as well as Open the Voice Gate. You can find Those Days on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast feed or on the dedicated Open the Voice Gate feed, wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow Open the Voice Gate on social media at Open Voice Gate. If you'd like to donate to the show, click the link in the show notes. It'll take you to our redcircle.com landing site. You click that red box that says sponsor this podcast, and you set up a one-time or recurring donation. No obligation whatsoever, but we would like to thank all of our previous donors. I'm one of your hosts for Those Days. I'm Mike Spears, and I'm joined alongside, as always, Case Lowe. And Case, last time on the program, we closed out 1993 with, at the time, a deepening relationship between Michinoku Pro and Atsushi Onita's Frontier Martial Arts Wrestling. And because of essentially this relationship of a media gadfly like Onita with someone who is trying to do something completely new in Sasuke, we saw some of the bigger houses of the promotion's history, at least through 1993. And we kicked off one of the real true testaments of Michinoku Pro, the multiple-year feud between Super Delphin and Sato. But it's 1994, Case.
It's 1994, you know, you go back through the first three episodes that we did. The first episode really touches on the uncertainty of Michinoku Pro simply based off the fact that nobody had done regionalized wrestling in Japan before. Episode two, we talk about the July 24th, 1993 show, the Sasuke versus Delphin main event, and how they drew over 1,000 fans, and how suddenly it seemed like maybe there was some viability with this concept. And then the last time we spoke about Michinoku Pro, like you said, Onita's there, Jerry Lynn's there, Sabu's there, and the wrestling media is there to cover Michinoku Pro. And as we enter 1994, something that I've hinted at with each and every episode so far is that you'll see very, very quickly Michinoku go from being an ally of FMW and being a respected indie to Michinoku being an ally of New Japan Pro Wrestling and really being on the cusp of mainstream pro wrestling in Japan. And although that doesn't necessarily happen until the next episode, what we'll get to in episode 5, you start to see the formation take place here because this episode is Michinoku Takes Tokyo, and you see a far greater presence in the Tokyo area immediately at the start of 1994 compared to anything they did in the first year that they were opened.
Yeah, and I think that this is the time, as we enter a new calendar year to talk about one thing that to this day makes Michinoku Pro different from most other promotions. Michinoku, throughout its time, January and February, they do not run very many shows, if any, within the Tohoku region. With the weather in northern Japan and just in general, I don't know if many of these venues are heated as well, so there is that. But Michinoku Pro goes dark in Tohoku, but they spend January and February, and they start in 1994 doing this. This is when they would go to, and they started their trips to Tokyo, as well as Osaka and the rest of southern Japan, and we kind of get to see this now take place here in 1994.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, you know, because the way our timeline is going to jump here, we obviously concluded with December of 1993, and here the one Michinoku Pro show that we have in full that we're going to talk about is at the end of March of 1994. And you might think, if you don't know, well, you know, why are you guys skipping 3 months? But like you said, you know, they run one show in Hokkaido and on January 14th, 1994. They run the Korakuen Hall show in Tokyo on February 4th, 1994. And then they don't resume action until the very beginning of March. And nothing of that makes tape in full until the end of March. And that is something that is a common occurrence with Michinoku Pro. Normally it's one show in January, no shows in February. Then they pick up in March because where they're located, it's just not a sustainable business model to actually run shows in January and February.
Yeah, and especially as it relates to this promotion, 1994 will be their most active year. They will have over 122 shows, at least according to Cage Match. And at least as of like this time and when things were really kind of kicking up, they have this very hot period that between throughout our period of the promotion that before it all ends, like I think, and I'm not going to do the math now, because of how they've run and when they came back from hiatus in 2000, they've already kind of deviated from this now where they will run more in January and February. But you were seeing a time where they would run three shows across February and January, and then another 119 shows in 1994. Mm-hmm. And in 1995, it's 127 shows. And in 1996, 136 shows. So the fact that they compress all of this within only 10 months and in reality, like, let's be honest, it's really sometimes upwards of 9 months. It's really something that I think we all should keep in stock and keep this at the front of our mind whenever we're talking about this time period, because it's not going to be because of a lack of trying, and it's just how it makes more functional sense. I mean, they only run five shows in December in 1994 as well, so it works both ways.
There you go. Well, let's kick off the timeline. We will close out 1993 here. This actually comes from an early 1994 Wrestling Observer newsletter. As we talk about awards, you know, something that would certainly be relevant to Michinoku Pro by the end of 1994, then again at the end of 1996 and 97, some of the more popular years for Western fandom for Michinoku Pro. But we do have this letter to Dave that comes again from an early 1994 Wrestling Observer newsletter, with the title being Rookie of the Year, and it reads, in balloting for Rookie of the Year, somebody should at least give mention to Wally Yamaguchi of Japan as Mr. Toyota, a U.S.-style heel manager for Michinoku Pro Wrestling. Although Wally has been around pro wrestling for most of his life, this is the first time he has used the character. His performance is nothing short of incredible, and he makes it look like he has been doing it for at least a decade. He has great timing and takes his share of big bumps at the right moment. I've tried my mind at managing on a small scale and can say from experience that it isn't as easy as it may look. It's not always easy to both work the crowd and pay attention to the match so you don't miss your cues for involvement in key spots. Yamaguchi does both almost flawlessly, and that is from Chris Zaviza in Plymouth, Michigan. Mike, I put this in here because I find it fascinating that, you know, between Sasuke and Shinzaki and, you know, Delphin at this point definitely wouldn't have been a rookie, but maybe somebody like Sato or Taka Michinoku might have been. And here we are shouting out Mr. Toyota, and I don't necessarily think they're wrong for doing that.
Yeah, I think when you look at where the Michinoku Pro roster was in 1993, if it's not going to be Toyota, it has to be at least Shinzaki kind of changing the character, or if you're going to claim it as like a best newcomer, just because when you look at the wrestlers that really are debuting in this promotion, and yeah, some of them did have time in Universal in 92, but Masato Yakushiji is not there. I know that folks end up liking him a little bit more so far than I do, and I'm ready to see him really evolve. But Nihiro Hoshikawa, not there either. So the person I immediately would point to has to be Mr. Toyota as Rookie of the Year for at least Michinoku Pro, if you're lumping in the idea that a lot of these guys had that experience from Universal.
Dave would write in the Observer newsletter around this time also that the Tokyo Sports Awards for 1993 were announced the highly political and nationalistic, as Dave put them. MVP of 1993, Junichiro Tenryu, match the year Tenryu versus Choshu from the Dome, January 4th, 1993. Masawa and Kobashi were tag team of the year. Masakatsu Funaki, best technical wrestler. Shinya Hashimoto, Fighting Spirit Award winner. Co-rookie of the years, Shinjiro Otani and Jinsei Shinzaki. Dave also noted that Great Sasuke was named most popular newcomer.
Yeah, and I think that this is like a nice instrument that proves that Tokyo sports and these awards have always been a highly negotiated and political sort of thing. I mean, you see how the awards, at least the major ones, are cleanly kind of divided between All Japan and New Japan, where you're able to still like point out, okay, Masakatsu Funaki, I'm trying to think, 93. Is he still back in New Japan at that point, or is he doing more indies, doing that, doing like shoot style stuff there?
I don't think he's in New Japan. In 93, he is, it's funny, Cage Match actually has no, he must be on Rings in 93, because Cage Match has no listing of him for 1993, actually.
Which Rings was kind of the dominant shoot style promotion at that point. So I think that you kind of get to see it piecemealed out in like such a manner. I do find it kind of interesting the way that it's like, oh yeah, Shinya Hashimoto Fighting Spirit Prize. And it's like, yeah, no, I imagine most years from 1993 to 2003, you could give that he filed for that definition. He might have the most Fighting Spirit Prize winners, just because if someone embodies that award in the 90s, it's Hashimoto, right?
And in 93 in particular is a good year for him.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, Tenryu in 93, he's headlining huge shows both in his own promotion and in New Japan. And so it feels like the inverse of what we have now, where in 93 you actually have a number of top level guys that could be considered for MVP, but the depth of Japan might not be as rich as it could have been. Mm-hmm. But between Choshu and Tenryu and Hashimoto, and then obviously Masawa Kobashi and what we would start to see with Kawada and Hansen still going strong at that point, you know, 93 has your true heavyweights, both in terms of actual weight and in terms of stature they take up in the industry. So that is what we have for the 1993 awards.
One last note. Interesting, because of how things are with FMW and Onita, and who is in his good books, or whose good books he's in at one time. Onita completely ignored it during these awards.
Yes, and that feels like if it was perhaps less politicized, maybe the Fighting Spirit Award might go to him, but instead Hashimoto does get it.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree.
Mike, we're going back to Mexico, at least hypothetically.
Is it time for our favorite segment of the show?
It's our favorite segment. It is what promotion Great Sasuke is working for in Mexico next, in a section that we are calling the greatest Sasuke feud that never was. And this is going to be lengthy. We're going to go through a few different Observer awards here, or I'm sorry, a few different Observer newsletters here. But I think this is all relevant because it shows the fact that Michinoku Pro was able to grow the way that they did in Japan. It is just an absolute miracle, because yes, professionally, I think for Sasuke or Delphin, working in Mexico before the economic crash in the mid-90s, I think it would have done both of those guys a world of good. It probably would have damaged Michinoku Pro, though. And so to read all of these news clippings about Sasuke going over to AAA at the beginning of 1994, to me, is just so fascinating. So, spoiler alert, Sasuke is going to Michinoku Pro, but we'll start here with the January 24th, 1994 Observer. This is a great read, because in this Observer, Dave takes a look at the wrestling world at large and accurately predicts that, hey, the world is going to get smaller, and if you're going to be a cutting-edge promotion, you not only need to take inventory of what is going on in your own region and in your own country, but we have a chance now to globalize wrestling in a way that I think largely we now see today. Dave was talking about how you could do this in 1994. He says, 1994 is going to be an interesting year. because it's becoming more and more apparent that the world is becoming a smaller place. Instead of ignoring what goes on in its industry and other parts of the world, as virtually all promoters of the past had done, events of the past few weeks have indicated more cooperation with various groups. The next round of technology changes in the television industry, which is a few years away in this country, is certain to have a profound effect of making the world a smaller place as well. Both WCW and AAA have had reps visit Japan in recent months. Eric Bischoff of WCW went to Japan in November to attempt to put together a deal that had fallen apart between WCW and New Japan. While no deal has been signed that we know of, and reports that we get out of New Japan are that they aren't willing to pay the type of price that it has in the past for WCW talent, the groups are willing to do a degree of talent exchanges that would hopefully augment each side's major shows. As mentioned last week, Rick Rude goes to New Japan for a week in March, and in exchange, Great Muta will come to WCW in April, including headlining the 4/17 Spring Stampede show from the Rosemont Horizon against Ric Flair. I mention that because it's relevant here. AAA's Antonio Pena, Octagon, El Hijo del Santo, and Fuerza Guerrera visited Japan as well during the first week of the year. Conan wasn't on the trip despite what was reported here. One of the magazines had a photo of Conan with Atsushi Onita, but apparently the photo was an old photo. On January 3rd, Pena, who's the AAA booker, met with Onita, the FMW president. The next day, he met with Seiji Sakaguchi and Antonio Inoki at the New Japan Post Tokyo Dome party and set up a business meeting with Sakaguchi for the next afternoon. Sakaguchi, Masa Saito, along with prelim wrestler Black Cat, and Pena's international liaison Jimmy Suzuki serving as translator, met the next day and made a verbal agreement to work together. That evening, Pena went to the FMW show to shoot an international interpromotional angle that will probably lead to a joint FMW AAA stadium show later this year. Pena, Octagon, Santo, and Guerrero were introduced to the crowd early at the Corgan Hall show and sat ringside. This again is the FMW January 5th, 1994 show. During a tag match, Michinoku Pro's Great Sasuke did an Asai moonsault to the floor on Jinsei Shinzaki, and in following through, crashed into Guerrero at ringside. The two started brawling and had to be separated. The next day before the Corgan Hall show, a press conference was scheduled to further the angle. Pena, Guerrero, Sasuke, and Onita were there. Pena apologized for what happened, claiming that they were not there to interfere in the matches. Onita said there was no need to apologize and that this is just something that happens. Guerrero then said that he had no reason to apologize, that he was sitting there minding his own business when Sasuke crashed into him. Then he threw a Coke in his face and the two brawled again. 3 days later, Sasuke came to Guadalajara to work the AAA show. However, due to visa problems, he wasn't able to work the main event, and instead, they just did another angle in the ring where he and Guerrero got into it again and set up a feud for both countries later in the year. We'll pause there, Mike. Sasuke works an FMW show. He gets into it with Fuerza Guerrero at ringside. And allegedly, and we'll talk about why this is alleged, Sasuke flies to Guadalajara 3 days later and shoots an angle on a AAA show with Fuerza Guerrero.
Yeah, and if you look at where the timing is, this does line up like that he could, but it would be a lot of very quick travel because Sasuke would go do this angle, then fly back up to get to Hokkaido on the 14th.
Yeah, you know, leaving Japan, going to Mexico, he just went about on the same flight as the AAA guys, I would imagine, and then, you know, it's one AAA show that we have record of him possibly working, and then him going back to Mexico. It makes sense. It's a busy week of travel. But it makes sense. So again, that all kicks off that FMW 1594 Corgan Hall show. They would run a doubleheader that day. So that's why the angle happens on the first show. The press conference happens before the second show. We continue on the January 24th, 1994 Wrestling Observer Newsletter. Now in the Mexico section, where Dave says the first major show of the year was the January 9th show in Guadalajara, which drew a sellout of 20,000 fans. Main event was an 8-man tag scheduled with Conan, El Barbero, Latin Lover, and Perro Aguayo in heavy metal versus Cien Caras, Blue Panther, La Parca, and Fuerza Guerrera. This also seems to make no sense since Caras and Mascara Año 2000 came out of nowhere and attacked Panther and not Conan at the last television taping of 1993. That's all AAA booking stuff that isn't totally relevant here. What is relevant is that Dave says this was the match where Great Sasuke showed up as all the main eventers were in the ring and was introduced as Octagon's friend from Japan, similar to how Pena introduced Yoshinori Asai as Ultimo Dragon a few years ago when he was the EMLL booker. All four heels and attack Sasuke. Dave also has this note. The plan is for Sasuke, Tiger Mask 3, which is Koji Kanemoto, and Hayabusa of FMW to form a babyface trio called the Bullet Trains of Japan and AAA. Mike, I hate to break it to you, this does not happen.
God, that would be like the most toxic trio, I feel like. Just Koji Kanemoto alone would be like that.
Yeah, you're saying there's some egos at play between Sasuke and Kanemoto?
No, never. I want to touch a little bit on the Octagon note, because this is, I think now, like when most people hear about Octagon, unless you're looking at that 90s footage, you kind of think of like this old legend guy who's wearing a mask that's not dissimilar to the former El Generico's mask. And
pulling a gun on Fulmita.
Yeah. But he was such a big star, especially towards the kids in the 90s. And I mean, like the first like real, I would say, other than Conan, Peña star in AAA was Octagon. So this bringing in Ultimo originally back in MLL with Octagon. Octagon's gimmick was always kind of a martial arts kind of character, right? So it all kind of matches up, and it's like a nice level of just like synchronicity that the Octagon has a lot of mass Japanese friends.
Yes, no, it works out. It works out nicely. Dave would write in the next week's Observer, this is January 31st, 1994. The Galavision show this weekend saw the Saturday show air from the January 5th show, as well as the main event from the January 9th Guadalajara show. And he notes that the main event from the Guadalajara show was the one where Great Sasuke from Japan was attacked by the heels before the match. However, the television picked up right after the attack, so the angle never aired on television. However, the announcers referred to El Gran Sasuke being attacked before the match by Frieza Guerrera, as the two are going to feud. February 21st, 1994, in The Observer, Great Sasuke debuts for AAA on a three-week tour starting March 7th. Mike, that does not happen. Dave would continue a few weeks later that Tiger Mask and Black Cat were in New Japan, and that Sasuke's debut in AAA that was supposed to start in March had been postponed due to April, but he was still planning to feud with Fuerza Guerrera. He would also write, and this is just an ongoing what if Sasuke and Fuerza Guerrera ever wrestled, on the FMW May 5th, 1994 show, Dave confirmed that Onita versus Tenryu was going to be the main event, and that Terry Funk would also appear, and that they were looking to bring in Fuerza Guerrera for a grudge match with the Great Sasuke. That does not happen. We also get this note, and we'll close it out here. Dave says, although this is not official, plans are being made for a Great Sasuke versus Super Delphin match on the March 17th show in La Puente, California, in the 200-seat La Puente Community Center show that will also have a show on February 26th using local wrestlers. A Japanese tour is coming to the United States for WrestleMania, and they are scheduled to be in Southern California that day. And since Delphin is going to be in California and Sasuke is going to be in Mexico working for AAA, they are going to put that match together largely for the Japanese fans. To my knowledge, Mike, none of this ever happens.
Oh, of course not. Sasuke has more important things to be doing in 1994 in April than to be doing like that. He does have a break in his schedule from March 6th to March 19th. So it does seem like that this could have worked out, but he's not working Mexico. So it's, I guess like the kind of like the, I would want to know more about this tour, because
I do too. I can't find anything on it.
It makes me wonder, like, I'm blanking. Oh, no, I remember his name, George Mayfield. That's a name that probably doesn't ring a bell for you, Case, but it might not. It might be for our more millennial and Gen X listeners. I wonder, George Mayfield was a regular presence in East Coast indie shows selling tapes, and he would put forward the Mayfield tours where he would take people to Japan in the 90s and 2000s. And it always was somehow like Hayabusa was always kind of incorporated with it. I think Mayfield was tight with Hayabusa at that. So I wonder if there's a situation, maybe it's Wally. Maybe Wally put it together, because it does kind of see like the kind of thing that either Wally or Sumoto Shimizu might do, you know?
And if it was tied into WrestleMania in some way, it would make sense for Wally to want a piece of that.
Oh, right. Yeah. Especially considering what his relationship would end up being in WWF in 3 years.
Very much so. We'll get to that here shortly. So all of this is to say, Sasuke never works an official match for AAA. He never has the FMW match with Fuerza Guerrera on the baseball stadium show. The only time that Sasuke and Fuerza Guerrera have wrestled each other. This is a match that actually did happen. There's no record of it on Cage Match, but I have seen footage of this match. I know it exists. On August 20th, 2000, Fuerza Guerrera finally comes to Michinoku Pro. This is beyond the point of which I care about Michinoku Pro. This is post-J Cup 2000, because that's in April, and this is in August of 2000. But Mike, we finally get a Sasuke versus Fuerza Guerrera match in August of 2000. Here we are in the spring of 1994, talking about how these guys were supposed to have an international multi-promotional feud, and none of it ever comes to fruition.
It's wild. You know, like you would think that, especially considering like where 1993 AAA was and with how like avid Pena really was about setting up these relationships, and it works out in the long term with him with WCW. But it does kind of feel like that Pena knows, all right, like I was known as like, and of course, like 92 AAA takes off, right? So he has the ground record, but like, the most important note about this is how accurately Dave pegs how the wrestling world becomes much more of a smaller and smaller place. It's not necessarily the technological changes in the television industry that rapidly change it. It's going to be the internet. But I do think that it's kind of fascinating that Dave was able to peg that even back in January of 94.
Yeah, I cut out a bunch of stuff there just for the sake of our podcast. But it's a very interesting read because he goes pretty in depth and he's right about a lot of stuff that, you know, 30 years later, people could still sort of heed the message of, and they don't necessarily do that. But it's a great read. Again, that is all from the, what was the Observer date there? The January 24th, 1994 Observer, if you would like to go back and read that. We go to Japan, as we're done now with Sasuke in Mexico, or not being in Mexico, hypothetically. And I should note, actually, before we move on, I reached out to Cubs fan. I said, have you ever seen photos of Sasuke and Fuerza brawling in Guadalajara? And he said no. Now, that's why I said allegedly earlier, look, if the announcers were mentioning that Sasuke got beat up, I'm sure Sasuke got beat up, but we have no video of it and no photo of it. And it's the only record we have of Sasuke being in AAA ever. So I find that to be just a fascinating historical anecdote.
Yeah, yeah. And especially, again, given where the media was and how 1994 and Pena really was trying to bridge that gap, you know, I mean, he would do it. They would do it in Los Angeles, of course, but like the aggressiveness to try to get in with a promotion that, I mean, you look at who was in UWA in 91, and a lot of those guys get pushed to EMLL, and this is not a UWA destruction podcast, but you had like that foundation of people that would make a lot of sense with AAA and Michinoku Pro and FNW in 94. Like that, like it's not for a lack of trying. I see the logic here, and it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, very much so. So we go back to Japan. Like we talked about at the top of this show, you know, they stop running the second week of December. They run one show in January, one show in February, and then they pick up back in March. The January show happens in Hokkaido, you know, a place that we now, you know, the people that listen to the weekly Dragon Gate updates that we do, obviously, they're very familiar with Dragon Gate doing Hokkaido two times a year. They do the triple shot in May. They do the triple shot in December. And off we go from there. So on January 14th, 1994, Michinoku has their first Hokkaido show. And Sasuke notes in his book, Sasuke Soars, which we've referenced a few different times now, that Sasuke promoted this event using a local advertising agency. And as a result, he got 3,500 people to show up to this event. And what this does here is you start to see just this demand for Michinoku Pro in a way that I'm not really sure there's anything like it in wrestling right now. Maybe on a larger scale, the equivalent is when Dynamite first rolled out and you started seeing the first Dynamite and then the first Dynamite in Texas and the first one in Boston. And then you had Arthur Ashe in New York and the first Dynamite in Chicago. And then they finally went to the West Coast and all of those things felt like a big deal. That is probably, or maybe, you know, the first few New Japan USA shows, I mean, those were a really big deal, but you're starting to see this countrywide demand. Even though Hokkaido is technically in Northeast Japan, it was a little further from where they had been running all of their shows, and yet they put one show in Hokkaido and over 3,000 people show up, Mike.
Yeah, and I think that there's like an important like kind of cultural context about this. The Tsugaru Strait is the body of water that is between Honshu, which is the major island of Japan, and the island of Hokkaido. And there's always kind of been like a cultural context about crossing the Sugaru Strait. And even like relating to Japanese high school baseball, where interestingly enough, Akira Tozawa's hometown is where the Japanese national baseball tournament goes on. And it goes on, Case, since before the days of Babe Ruth. The stadium has existed.
Okay.
But whenever a team from Hokkaido comes down and wins the national tournament, they make a big deal of, oh, they crossed the Sugaru Strait. So just kind of like a little bit of like a cultural kind of little touch there.
And that's what Michinoku was doing here. They were crossing the Sugaru Strait, and it was the first time they had done that.
Right. And I think that I find Hokkaido so interesting, at least with like wrestling promotion, because you always see whenever promotions go to Hokkaido, the houses are usually pretty great. And I think that a lot of that is the fact of like people and the idea of the island and the strait there. But even back in 94, I mean, getting basically 3,000 people there, and it's a show that they are not going to be taking in a lot of money on, but still 3,000 people coming out for a show that was put on with Michinoku Pro's name.
Sabu versus Yone Genjin on that show. Thankfully, we do not have footage of that. The other bit of expansion that happens here is February of 1994. Michinoku Pro runs Cork and Hall for the first time. It should be noted, as soon as tickets were put on sale for this show, tickets sold out. And this is something that made Sasuke incredibly nervous. He had promised himself, outside of the one TV taping that we talked about in August of 1993, he talked about dedicating the first year of Michinoku Pro's existence strictly to Northeast Japan, strictly to Iwate. He wanted to keep it local and keep it regionalized, and he did not want to expand too quickly. There was a pro wrestling ticket company called Battle Clip, however, that reached out to Sasuke about running a Michinoku Pro show in Cork and Hall, noting that they had seen demand for Michinoku in Tokyo. Sasuke, and he explains this in a video interview, and I'll talk about how we got to this video interview in just a second, but Sasuke said that he felt guilty about running a show outside of Tohoku, but that he wanted to offer something for the fans that had supported him through the Universal era. So he agrees February 4th, 1994, Michinoku Pro is going to run Cork and Hall, and as soon as they put tickets on sale, tickets sold out, Mike.
Yeah, and it's worth noting Battle Clip. This is similar to the situation in Hokkaido, different company, but when we talked about in episodes 2 and episodes 3 that there were some level of independent shows dating back to the 80s, most of those shows we put on by like companies like this that would basically buy out the roster for the night and do a sold show, and they would take the ticket ticket proceeds. But in this one, it does kind of seem like that, at least from how the way that Sasuke spoke to him about, they did not get like their fee up front. The fee was contingent on the Michinoku Pro show on February 2nd in Tokyo going off.
So how would you describe the financial setup for this show? Is this like, was this a sold show? Would you put it that way?
You know, at least from the way that I would kind of look at it, Case, it's sold, but it's done in the max of, okay, it's the fact that it was not Michinoku Pro's money put up for the show. It was Battle Clip, basically.
Yeah.
Like it's not the idea of, and just to pull a modern Dragon Gate context, the show center shows that they would do, where they would go to set up a ring and do two matches at a home goods store that's happened over the last few years. Those are pure sold shows. Whenever promotions do stuff at Kirin or boat races or anything with like that kind of thing as a part of that, that's a sold show. This one, to me, and at least through my research, it really feels like it's like a situation that Battle Clip might not be dissimilar from a modern day context to what Ledette was before they owned Noah, basically.
Okay.
That's at least that, because at least Ledette before 2017, they were putting on the Fortune Dream shows. I think they had someone else's produce shows that they were doing as well. And that's kind of the vibe. And well, one of the things we had to talk about, and this is something that we're going to be encountering now, but it'll be less so of an issue as we move to like 96 and 97. We basically, for this incident and for what happened on February 2nd, 1994. It up until basically 2 weeks ago, all we had was like a paragraph on the Observer for 1994 and then whatever digitized news reports came from 1994. This was before really like Tokyo Sports was posting on the internet. So it's kind of still at this day for us, I feel like, a little bit of a murky situation, but I think we have a lot of new information that we could kind of bring to light about it. I mean, the reports, Baseball Magazine said it was 40 million yen for
so,
that was
so
lost.
just to be clear, so what happens is Michinoku Pro, they run Corken, they sell it out as soon as tickets go on sale, but the story that has existed for the last 30 years is that the promoter ran off with the money and that Michinoku ended up, not intentionally, but ended up doing this show as volunteers. They never got paid for the show. They never made any of the money.
They passed the hat.
Yes, and they never made any of the money off this Corken show that they were supposed to make. Explain the process. So what happened is we found about a 12-part Sasuke video interview series on YouTube. I forget what channel it's on. It's all in Japanese, so I'm not going to plug it. Mike, what did you do, if you don't mind sharing, to try to get us more information about this specific scenario? Because I asked around. I asked some people that might know. Nobody seemed to know who Battle Clip was, what happened. It was just this story that had been going around for 30 years at this point of Michinoku ran Corken, the promoter ran off with the money. You did some investigative work to try to get more information on that.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about modern technology and ways that you can use it for good and not evil. As to native English speakers moderate, maybe, like, ability to communicate in other languages, it's very hard to find sometimes this information. Like, when I was talking about, like, all this stuff is digitized, like, all the reporting is just stuff that happened there the day. This Sasuke interview, though, is really fascinating. He was doing this in the middle of COVID, and he kind of goes through his entire career. Like, okay, so I have a new clip I need to get to you for episode 5 about it, but what is, and this is an issue with technology where this is posted on YouTube. And one of like the fortunate things about YouTube is that sometimes they have auto translate for captions. And more often than not, it's not perfect. Sometimes it's okay. I remember the Yamato translation on YouTube was very good. But the issue that you had with the YouTube algorithm is that, and I only experienced this from like after I pulled the clip and did some work with it, Kiz, was that the YouTube auto captions, whatever program it is looking for mouth movement. And Sasuke, in this interview, he has on a full face mask. I think it was done like in 2022, so in the middle of COVID. But there's a guy off screen asking questions. So the YouTube captions program is only able to get about 40-50%, and we weren't able. It was not usable at that point, right? Like, it was just like there's things talked about, but we can't really discern that. The Google translation service is awful. What you should do, and this is something that if you're looking for these kinds of things, the programs are out there. You're able to do this. There's better translation programs, in particular DeepL. What essentially I had to do, Case, was rip the video and then tell DeepL to keep track of all audio, not just when mouths were moving. And then I was able to get a full transcript that we were able to work with. But it's not that the company ran off the money is the big conclusion that we can say here, at least from Sasuke.
Yes, after finding a way to transcribe, yeah, and then translate it, we seem to have a more accurate understanding of the story of the promoter ran off with the money.
Right. And what happened, at least from the Sasuke video that he talks about, is that he was doing work with Battle Clip, but he was doing work with the number 2 for Battle Clip. It was like the vice president of Battle Clip. 4 a.m. at the day of the show, he got a call from the number 2 and saying that they could never find the number 1, the president. And Sasuke admits, I've never met with the president. I only dealt with this guy here who was the one kind of in charge of running our show. But now he wokes him up at 4 a.m. the day of the show saying, there is no president. We don't know where it is. But the ticket sales and everything were so strong, and Sasuke was so sensitive about the situation about, okay, we're Tohoku. Like, outside of another Tokyo double shot they do this year, they don't run Tokyo again until 1995. So they're a Tohoku promotion, but he has such allegiance to his fans that were there during the Universal days that he went on with the show. Even as the show happened, no one heard the president. And then Sasuke cut an interview that in the middle of the ring that became the cover of Baseball Magazine for that week, where he basically says, hey, we don't have any money. We don't know where the Battle Clip guy is, and we're wrestling the show for free. We're going to kind of pass the hat around. And he talks about how that was something in Universal that that the fans picked up on, the money throwing. It turns out later that they found out that the president of Battle Clip was dead, that he was found dead in his apartment. So no wonder he didn't hear from them. But the guy in charge of the company was dead. And
then he had died, what, the if the Korakuen show was on the 4th, he died, what, on the 3rd?
Yeah, on the 3rd. And by the time that the show was done and everything, they did not know about it. But afterwards, it was a 40 million yen in 1994, which is an insane amount of money, considering in 1993, Sasuke talks about that his family is essentially $160,000 in debt because of Michinoku Pro. They never get this $40 million yen or 40 million yen. Never get
so,
it.
So that is what we understand to be a more updated version of that story. Again, it's not that the promoter was there, saw how much money they were making, and took off with it in the middle of the night, but rather that guy was dead before the Korakuen Hall show even happened. It's why the number two had panicked and called Sasuke in the middle of the night to say that he couldn't make contact with him the day of the show because he had gone 24 hours without hearing from his boss at that point. And so, you know, it's
who was that?
Who was dead, so that's why he didn't hear from him. And so, you know, like you said, Mike, Sasuke begins this Michinoku Pro Korakuen Hall show with a promo saying, like, hey, you know, we're here as volunteers tonight. We're going to do our best, but here's the situation that happens. And what we get is a main event that features the first great six-man tag in Michinoku Pro Wrestling history and one of my favorite matches that I've ever seen come out of Michinoku.
Yeah, so the main event of the February 4th, 1994, Michinoku Pro debut at Korakuen Hall was the babyface side of Great Sasuke, Shiryu, and Sato going up against, for the first time we have on Michinoku Pro footage, the complete Delphin Corps of Super Delphin, Grand Nanawa, and Jinsei Shinsaki. Sasuke wins with the K-Brata inside the ring on Nanawa, and you really get to see this real kind of fascinating match that kind of puts us on the road for what would be one of the major feuds in the promotion over 1994, where in the first 5 minutes, it's all about Sato and Delphin. Sasuke and Shinsaki don't touch until well at like 6-7 minutes into the match.
I think the interesting thing about this match, a lot of people, I go back to, like, say, the Ditch listings, right? The old Ditch site that, for those that don't know, was at an incredible time and place on the internet where Ditch was a guy who had compiled all of these incredible Japanese wrestling matches from the beginning of time up through about 2014 is when that site stopped getting updated. And it was download links for all of these matches that he liked. He would have a brief description. He would have the promotion, the date. It was a phenomenal resource, really helped expand my fandom when I started watching this sort of stuff. So, you know, he's got a bunch of Michinoku Pro matches listed on his site. And this is the one that a lot of people start with. He has a few from 1993, you know, Sasuke versus Delphin, and I think the second Sato and Delphin match, the one from December. I know those were listed on his site, but he even writes, you know, when he's describing this match, like, this is really, truly when Michinoku Pro begins. They do it in front of a sold out Korakuen crowd. The crowd is insanely hot for this match. And it's funny thinking about this match in the context of Universal, where, again, you have to remember, Mike, you know, they're working Universal through June of 1993. So 8 months ago, Sasuke and Delphin would headline Universal shows in front of 1,000 people in a dead audience with luchadors that weren't over. And in record time, it feels like. I mean, there's nothing really, you know, to compare it to, but we'll say for the point of dramatic effect, in record time, Michinoku Pro creates so much buzz through magazines and home videos that in February of 1994, they sell it out, and everybody is biting at every Sato versus Delphin interaction and every Shinsaki versus Sasuke interaction. They know the moves, they know the stories, and this match is out of this world good.
I think what I really appreciated was how much they were allowing everything to simmer throughout it and basically not letting Sasuke get any offense in on Shinsaki through their opening interactions until really Dolphin's course kind of starts messing up, but really Nanawa just like being Nanawa and allowing the babyface army to kind of get on advantage. It's a real fascinating way of kind of doing a slow burn trios match.
I think it will start to sound repetitive, especially if you binge these episodes. But one of the things that has to be mentioned is in a match with Shinzaki and in a match with Delphin and a match with Sasuke, among others, this is the Sato show. You know, Sato looks so not only competent, I mean, he looks like the best wrestler in the world in the confines of this match. And I think at this point, he is the best wrestler in the promotion.
Oh, easily. And he has like the most 90s look too. Like it. One of the hidden joys is seeing Dick Togo early on and basically being in full on Steiner's mode with the mullet and the singlet at this point.
Yeah, he's incredible. There's his babyface comeback, the way that he's able to string offense together with just him against three separate guys.
Yeah.
It sort of blurs the line if it's almost like the type of thing you would expect to see out of an action movie or like a kung fu movie, but Sato does it in a way that is really grounded in the world of wrestling. And as dumb as this might sound, as hoity-toity as this might sound, he seems to just have a greater understanding of human momentum and what happens if one guy is standing behind him, one guy is standing in front of him, and the guy standing in front of him charges at Sato. If Sato moves out of the way, he's going to hit the guy standing behind him instead. It's just there's all this stuff that feels highly complex because it's packaged in a Lucha-Resu Trios match, but Sato's offense specifically is like this insanely simple human instinct. If I throw a guy at another guy, they're both gonna fall down sort of thing. And I don't know if anybody is quite doing that now. Like Sato's offense in this match is different than I think there's modern day Delphin archetypes, at least in the confines of a six man. And you know, Shinzaki is the muscle. You could look at a guy like Ishin and Dragon and go, okay, he's kind of doing the Shinzaki thing. Sasuke, obviously nobody is like Sasuke, but he's the beat down babyface who's gonna keep on fighting. That sort of thing I see. I'm not sure I see anybody doing Sato's offense in wrestling today.
And if there's anyone doing kind of like a modern equivalent, it is such a departure from it. Like, at least in this match, you know who the person in modern wrestling I think has that a little bit of just physics-based offense?
Who's that?
Darby Allin.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah, I could see that.
Like, but it's not one-to-one because Darby is 150 pounds soaking wet, and Sato, even at this time, was a beefy a junior heavyweight, and I don't know if you could really call him a junior heavyweight at that point, but it's just phenomenal work throughout it, and the way it builds up to, obviously, in a match like this, your eye goes to the babyface side, to Nanawa being the one that you're going to pick off, and the way that the babyfaces were able to kind of trying to do, like, we're trying to do a one of like now like the famous multi-man spots based around doing crab holds, and Nanawa comes in through the pen doing kind of like the chicken shit style, and then after that it just leaves him wide open for the rest of the babyface army to take him out.
It's an incredible match. It is, again, like I said, it's the first great trios match that we have footage of in Michinoku. We've seen at this point a lot of great singles matches, a lot of very good to great singles matches. There is the Sasuke Onita stuff that we watched in December, but that's not a Michinoku Pro six man. This is what it feels like the company's built off of from here. And the crazy thing is, it's a lot like watching, say, one of the high end Toriumon matches from 2000 or 2001, where you can at the same time say, oh, this is the foundation of what everything was built on, but also, very rarely did they ever get better than this. I mean, this is as good of a six-man as I think there is in Michinoku Pro.
Yeah, and I think it's fascinating that the six-man is something that does not come up at all in 93.
This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter. Hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Other than when they go to FMW stadium shows and they put on like an offer match.
It's the type of thing that if you go back and look at the match listings of 1993 for all of the shows, they're there. They're just not on TV. You know, in April of 93, sort of onwards, because I was looking specifically at Dick Togo, at his cage match and what he's doing in 93. And it's all of these really cool looking trios matches that we just don't have. And then when they would film, it was oftentimes either a big Delphin singles match or a big Sasuke singles match or them coming together and wrestling in a singles match. And you're right, 93, it's so different than Toriumon, where they kick things off and they go, we're doing trios matches. We are the trios match company. Michinoku Pro would become that, but they don't start like that.
Yeah, and you kind of, by the time you're in 94, at least when you look at the people that are on the bottom end, at least of work rate, your Shiryus and your Nanawas, it really shows that they've kind of gotten the experience and the confidence to finally kind of put them in those situations. Because in 1993, it would not be Shiryu in this match. It would be Leopardo Negro or Taka at that point.
Yes. Yeah, very, very well said. We continue here, February 14th, 1994, Wrestling Observer Newsletter. Akio Sato, the WWF rep in Japan, attended the February 4th Michinoku Pro Show at Corcoran Hall and announced that Great Sasuke and Jensei Shinzaki would work the four WWF dates in May in Japan. And then Dave notes that this show sold out weeks in advance, that being the Michinoku Pro Corcoran Hall show. And on that show, they did a contract signing angle for the March 4th show in Osaka, which would be the group's first card in Osaka that would be headlined by Delphin versus Sato in a mask versus hair match. Now, I mentioned this here, either in the next episode or I think it's even really the one after that. I think episode six.
Yeah,
is when we really start to dive into the 1994 WWF Japan tour. But I do want to mention that here that, again, to talk about notoriety and level of intrigue and kind of the hot ticket in town, the WWF rep is not at, say, the WAR show that Sasuke works that we're just about to talk about. He's not at any of the FMW shows. It's not like Sasuke is in New Japan at this point. The WWF rep is going to the Michinoku Pro show to recruit Sasuke and Shinzaki for the WWF tour that happens later in 1994. Of course, spoilers, Shinzaki works the tour, Sasuke does not.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that Akio Sato ends up later on becoming the manager of Jensei Shinzaki as Hakushi in WWF. So this is someone that will be a little bit of a figure, but just kind of interestingly kind of pokes up that. And I think it's notable the fact that WWF had a pretty good relationship with Genichiro Tenryu up until this point. Like,
oh, hell yeah.
One would think that they would obviously be, instead looking for WAR, it would be like, hey, is Ultimo available on this WAR tour? That's the Japanese guy we would get. That's what I would expect going into this versus them going to Michinoku Pro. The fact they go to Michinoku Pro over an established partner, I mean, they ran that dome show with SWS in 92. Like, I think that's very notable.
Well, do you think it's because Shinzaki is at least on the cusp of being a heavyweight?
I think there's an aspect of that. I mean, Shinzaki never really was a slight guy. I mean, he's billed right now at 108 kilos. So even in 94, you're still talking about someone that if you're within that kind of range there, you're going to be treated as a heavyweight, whereas you're not able to do that ever with Ultimo or with Great Sasuke.
I just think, you know, if you're going to poach somebody, for lack of a better term, from WAR for that tour, so you're talking May of 1994, and if you need somebody that can wrestle a Bret Hart or a 1-2-3 kid, so again, you're kind of looking for a power junior at that point, like, go and look at the card for the WAR show that we're just about to talk about here, March 2nd, 1994. It's, you know, Super Strong Machine and Koji Kitao and our friend Ishin Ricky, and then, you know, Goto, you know, Tarzan Goto and Shurahara. It weirdly makes sense that, like, hey, if you're going to look for one of these guys, in Japan and you can't use New Japan or All Japan. Shinzaki, and I don't say this just with the benefit of hindsight, I try to look at the lay of the land. Shinzaki is kind of the perfect guy for that roster and that scenario at that time.
Yeah, no, I mean, he like really pops in like new generation stuff, you know, like it. And when you like look at this WAR show from Sumo Hall, it is such like a departure from what you would think WAR and how like the stars really are at that point. Because I mean, you're doing Super Strong Machine versus Chris Jericho as Lionheart for 8 minutes, like right after intermission. Like it's just like kind of a interestingly kind of a little bit weird promotion at that point. I mean, Koji Kato has a 4 minute semi main on the show against Ishin Ricky.
So let's talk about WAR, because also on that February 14th, 1994 Observer, it's written that a press conference, as reported here last week, was held on January 28th in Tokyo to announce Junichiro Tenure versus Atsushi Onita, pitting the number one wrestler from WAR against the number one wrestler from FMW on the March 2nd Sumo Hall show. When the actual lineup was announced, the main event was announced as promotion versus promotion, with Tenryu and Hara against Onita and Tarzan Goto, probably to hold off on the inevitable first singles match between the two until later in the year, perhaps the 5-5 Kawasaki Baseball Stadium show, which is what happens. The remainder of the card also features Ultimo Dragon, and this is listed here as Yuji Yorisaoka versus Great Sasuke and Sato. The match, of course, would end up being Ultimo Dragon and Masa Orihara against Sato and the Great Sasuke. So we have a slight change there. But WAR in 1994, WIR in 1994, a weird promotion, because the promotion, for all intents and purposes, peaks in 1993. That is the year of New Japan versus WIR. That's when Tenryu gets his foot in the door in New Japan. That's when guys like Fujinami start working WIR. The intensity, the heat is off the charts. But Tenryu makes a conscious decision to break away from New Japan because he didn't just want to feel like New Japan light. And so this is really when WAR gets weird and you start to see those bizarre six-man tags that we all look at and go like, oh my God, it's Gato, Jado, and Bam Bam Bigelow together or whoever. You start to see a formation with FMW, a partnership form there, and you start to see, hey, we're running Sumo Hall. We need something special outside of this main event. Mike, let's call the Michinoku Pro guys. And so on March 2nd, 1994 in Sumo Hall, on the WAR Revolution Rumble in Ryogoku, we get this tag match that is Ultimo Dragon and Masao Orihara against Sato and the Great Sasuke.
28 minutes, the longest match on the show by far. And we get to encounter something that we will encounter a lot in 1994 with Michinoku Pro and other promotions in this match, in that the other promotions, as you like laid out, need to have something special. So they bring in Sasuke, who is the most popular newcomer, as according to Tokyo Sports. So that makes a whole lot of sense from a business sense. That's not always going to go over well with your roster itself, as we see in this tag team match, where just outright, we just had to say it off the top, considering how highly, at least through 1994, Sasuke views Ultimo Dragon, and we have proof of this through his autobiography, Ultimo does not feel the same way about Sasuke, and certainly not Orihara towards Sato. This is a match where that breaks down and turns almost into a shoot match because of the amount. I think credit to Saito and Sasuke that they didn't lose it on Ultimo and Orihara, but they were just stiffing them nonstop and being uncooperative and making the Michinoku guys look like absolute idiots in this match.
It's a really interesting dynamic. You think back to the first episode, and I was referencing Dr. Lucha, who was a journalist who helped book Michinoku Pro and did the commentary for Champ Forum. And, you know, he was a guy that in the mid-years of Universal had a conversation with Hamada, and they were raving about, of course, you know, Yoshinari Asai, Ultimo Dragon. And Hamada says, yeah, but Sasuke can do everything he can do. He can jump higher. He can move better. He can do all these things. Like Sasuke, who was at the time Ultimo's junior, is the guy that you really need to pay attention to. And it's funny that, you know, in July of 1994, a show we'll obviously talk about, Ultimo comes and works Michinoku Pro. They promote it as sort of a universal reunion show because Gato and Jado are also there. But Ultimo, in March of 1994, does not want to share the spotlight with these Michinoku guys whatsoever. Dave writes in the February 21st, 1994 Observer, on the March 2nd war card at Sumo Hall, the Ultimo Dragon and Masao Orihara match against Sasuke and Sato was a disappointment, since Dragon and Orihara didn't want to make the duo from the quote minor league promotion look good. Sasuke was really over big since fans were chanting for Sasuke during the prelim matches and in an early match when Fuyuki faced Arashi and they went to a time limit and Fuki asked for 5 more minutes. The fans started to boo and started chanting, "We want Sasuke." And when the ref ordered the match to restart, fans were chanting, "End this match," which shows a few things here. One, it shows that these WAR shows are just absolutely bizarre. Two, it shows there is something palpable and literal and physical happening with Sasuke, even by the beginning of 1994, pre-Super J Cup, that just cannot be ignored.
Yeah, and you really get to kind of see Ultimo kind of be this prick, which I think is fun in this. But you also have to have the mentality. In 1994, we've talked about this on our Rewind and Rewatch series. Ultimo is on a different level, not just like in ring, but also he is the most highly paid foreigner in Mexico at this point. And it makes a lot of sense why Ultimo's going like, "Oh, I have to face my junior in this match." And now they all kind of like him and he's kind of become this breakout star, not going to Mexico and becoming like this like sensation, but instead by putting his body through it all and becoming such a media presence. I think it's kind of understandable. It's not excusable, but I think it's understandable, at least like Ultimo's mindset going into this. And Orihara is such a prick in this match.
Orihara works this match in a way that you would expect a triumphant and proud junior heavyweight who is wrestling invading junior heavyweights to wrestle this match. It is Ultimo who doesn't bring that level of intensity, but does present himself with that level of hatred, if that makes sense. Like, Ultimo almost looks disinterested at times. He looks like he hates being there, whereas Orihara is kind of doing what we would later see with, like, Liger and Pro Wrestling Noah.
Right, yeah. And you look across the ring, and Sasuke getting all of this reaction, and we have one of the more brutal Sasuke botches to his career at this match. And the crowd still absolutely loves him. It's has to be so frustrating if you're Ultimo and you see your junior botch the Sasuke special pretty bad and the crowd still go crazy for it. Like, it's really fascinating.
It is, and it's a match that, I mean, God, it's listed at 28 minutes. I feel like we get most of that in the taping.
It feels like an hour.
It feels like an hour, and it's weird. Like, there's spurts of this match that are not bad. There's times where you'll have a sequence or two where, like, all right, it's going to pick up. Here we go. I like where this is going. And then it grinds to a halt once again. And it's the sort of thing, and you mentioned it earlier, and you're right to. It is interesting watching Ultimo in this situation feel jealous to some degree and feel like he doesn't want to do business with Sasuke. Now, of course, it's hard to analyze this beef much further because Ultimo ends up coming in and working a Michinoku Pro show here in just a few months. But man, in this match, Ultimo was just not having it.
Yeah. Interesting note. The crowd popped huge for Saito doing a La Magistral, which I have to imagine just pissed off Ultimo even more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so.
The Ultimo wins with a German suplex hold on Sato. This is, again, we're going to encounter situations like this a lot over 1994, especially as we get past the Super J Cup. But it's worth noting already the quote unquote major leaguers are already kind of pissed off about Michinoku Pro.
It should be noted that we'll return to WAR later this year as Sasuke would wrestle Ultimo Dragon in a singles match for the UWA World Middleweight Championship. That comes in July of 1994, and we'll talk about that when we get to it. But Mike, we now have to go to Osaka because we've got Super Delphin's hometown, the first Michinoku Pro Osaka show in history, and it's another chapter in Delphin versus Sato.
That's right. They are at the Rinkai Center. 2563 is announced, and it's visibly, I think, at least to this point outside of the FNW studio shows, easily like the biggest crowd it feels like for a Michinoku Pro show, even though those Awate shows with Onita were claimed at 2,000 to 2,100. This one, it was packed from just from the gills. And we got to have Super Delphin in his hometown. He defeats Sato by kind of doing a low blow, attempting to block a Rana, and then immediately collapsing on top of him for the pin in a match where, Kate, I'm just going to outright say this. I've warned you, I have a take here on this match. This match is not nearly as good as the one in Iwate, because the Osaka crowd does not ever at any moment think that Delphin's losing this match.
That is a fair take. You know,
they're just not into it. They're only into it for Delphin fighting off Sato, but they never buy any of Sato's near falls because they think, oh, no, Delphin's going to win in his hometown.
That's true. And, you know, let it be a bad omen for Michinoku Pro that they go to Osaka for the first time. It's a show promoted by Super Delphin, a show headlined by Super Delphin. And it does tremendous business with the crowd not buying that Delphin could ever lose in Osaka.
Yeah, and it's only really until, and in this match, a lot more deliberate than the match in 93, like opening up. And until until Sato goes for the La Magistral, the crowd's just not really buying into him. And I think it was only because of La Magistral that they start buying into it. But then really, as like the Delphin clutch doesn't work, the swinging DDT, that's when the crowd kind of falls in line. And I'm still trying to wrap my head kind of around this finish too. Okay.
So I think what happens, and it's a match where I actually really like the work, just because I like these two guys so much and I like their chemistry with one another. And for anybody that's maybe trying to hunt this down, now we're going to provide a link to this match for those that haven't seen it. I'm going to send you that YouTube link here in a day or two, Mike.
Yep, but yep.
There is a Michinoku Pro Sato versus Delphin commercial DVD release. So it's the match in September, the match in December, highlights of the January show in Hokkaido that we talked about. It is the main event of the Cork and Hall show in 1994. That's how we have that footage, is because of this comp DVD and then this match. So it's obviously, it's an incredible collection of work here. It is much like the September and the December match. These are not long matches. These guys do not get in the ring and waste time one another. I think what happens on the finish of this match is that Sato goes for a standing Hurricane Rana, like right. A Frankensteiner type thing, which is something that we've seen him do. And I don't know, you know, you mentioned maybe it was a low blow. It kind of looks like Delphin just shoves him to the ground, kind of like a big kid would shove down a little kid, and then pins him out of nowhere. And it is deflating and yet effective, because if you watch it just as a standalone match, it is a deflating finish, because it feels like they're really on their way to doing something special. And then it just ends, and it's kind of heel heat, and it's like, oh man, this sucked. Like, I wanted more.
But it's not
this.
Heel heat in that building that views Delphin as a huge technico.
You're right about that. And the other, I guess the benefit of this is, if you watch it in the way that we've been watching it, where you're watching all of this footage, even if Delphin gets cheered at parts of this match and towards the finish, it's such a Delphin thing to do. Like, you think about what a dick this guy has been for the first year of Michinoku Pro, and he not only takes this guy's mask, but 3 months later he takes his hair and he does it like this. Oh, I mean, if I was Dick Togo, I of course I would have turned heel and formed Kaientai, because I can't live with Delphin doing what Delphin has done to me. I mean, it is a dastardly finish that, again, works way better in context than it does in a vacuum, but it is still a very odd finish at that.
Yeah, and you have the post-match where Delphin is kind of not interested too much in the shaving of the hair. The babyfaces try to defend Sato, and I don't know if that was, hey, this finish wasn't exactly what it's supposed to be, so let's do kind of that thing. But after a while, the Delphin Corps clears the ring at this point. Yone Genjin is fully Delphin Corps at this point, including someone that we will see a lot later. We'll have a Monkey Magic joining the mix. But then the Delphin gets like basically one clipper's stroke worth of hair and just immediately throws it in the crowd and goes, hey, guys, I did it, and just walks out. It's really cool if you're a Delphin fan.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's been one of our big takeaways. And we've gotten numerous messages from people that have been listening of like, I'm, you know, this podcast has been great because it's a reminder of how great Super Delphin once was. And it's, again, it's more of that here. This is a 15-minute match that if it goes 25, is probably as good as anything we got from junior heavyweights in 1994, but it ends so abruptly that it's jarring. But the work that happens before the finish, even with the weird crowd stuff, again, I think the work here is phenomenal.
Yeah, and it really does kind of highlight something that we'll see later, that hey, Delphin doing his own thing kind of comes into conflict with Sasuke a lot. So the fact that he promotes a show that does the biggest house, at least in company quotation marks history, mattering how you consider that Hokkaido show, I think that's something that's worth noting before we get into how 98-99 go.
No, I'm sure it's fine. I'm sure everything's fine.
Everyone's going to be friends. I mean, there's one strong Michinoku Pro that still exists to this day.
Well, let me put it this way, not to jump, you know, 6 years ahead in our timeline, but it's why I find the Sasuke Mexico stuff to be as interesting as it is, because part of the reason that Delphin ends up splitting from Michinoku Pro and forming Osaka Pro is that in 1997, Sasuke fucks off all around the globe when he's going to, you know, he's going to the WWF and he's going to ECW. And, you know, it looks like Mexico, you know, he does CMLL maybe in 99, so it's not quite then yet. I think he goes to CMLL after the split. But either way, Sasuke is not at home promoting Michinoku Pro shows. Who's at home promoting Michinoku Pro shows? It's Super Delphin. And Michinoku Pro suddenly is okay without Sasuke. And so it opens, you know, this window of anger that Delphin has to say, fuck this, I'm going to go start Osaka Pro because I'm sick of feeling unappreciated. That could have happened in 1994 or 1995 if everything that Sasuke had planned on doing ends up coming to fruition.
Oh, yeah. No, easily. If Sasuke is fucking off doing 3-week tours of AAA, and if he's the one that gets the WWF deal, I think that this becomes a 6-episode podcast series.
You know, fucking off to AAA at a time where AAA is red hot, and he's probably going to end up making
a ton of money
there.
I don't think he will be able to repay or get in the black. But he talks about how much money that the headliners were making in UWA and how good even just being in the openers for UWA shows were for him at that time. I think that it similarly and reflexively, you would get a bit of a Ultimo and Toriumon situation happening real quick.
Yeah, I think that's exactly. I mean, that's what takes down Toriumon in 2004. You know, Ultimo leaves and those guys aren't making any money, and everybody's going, well, wait a minute, hold on, we're here, we don't need Ultimo, and we're still not making any money. What are we doing here? And Delphin, it's, you know, it's a little different, but it's largely the same thing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I really like at this point in Michinoku Pro where you have Delphin kind of like, we've seen him now essentially for a year. Now, I mean, we do not get the anniversary show that happens in Yahaba on the 18th that does not make tape, but essentially for a whole year he has been the biggest bastard possible, and how that will kind of break out and how this match that ends up being kind of awkward ends up being that tipping point about really the golden age that would come in 96.
Yeah, very much so. And that's, you know, that's part of the interesting thing that I think we have in this specific batch of footage is there's a lot of like 1993 is, oh, they're figuring it out. Okay, this is kind of the tone that Michinoku Pro would take. And in 1994, it's like, oh, there is really something special happening here. This is a different promotion than just your run-of-the-mill indie promotion at the time.
Yeah, and then you have this kind of B that, okay, your preseason ends with that, and before you know it, they're already back on tour, starting off in Yahaba 2 weeks later, really starting off the traditional Michinoku Pro calendar.
That's right. And so after a very slow January with one show, after a very slow February with one show, you get to March, you run the Osaka show, and then you're right, from the middle of March onwards, they are back on that full-time schedule. And what we get is a full show from March 31st, 1994. This is in Noshiro, Akita, Japan at the Noshiro City Gymnasium. This show aired in full. It aired in clips on Gaiora, but we have a Nico Nico rebroadcast of this show in HD in full. And boy, is this a show that I did not want to watch all of, Mike.
Yeah, so we kind of get like where the company is at kicking off their traditional schedule in 1994 on this show. I think like your up top stuff remained to be as strong as you see. But what you really get now at this point in 1994, you have like a couple set acts that are going to eat up time on the show. And in particular, the Wilkins Genjin act just becomes a situation that you remove that match from the show. It's a 4-match show. It's not super special, but it eats up so much time and energy. It's kind of a wonder that the crowd gets so up for the last two matches because how deadening
of a crowd brawl that was.
It is a tough watch. Matches 1-2 and then especially 3. At the very least, matches 1 and 2 inoffensive, but nothing special whatsoever. Match 3. That's as low as we've gotten yet on this Michinoku Pro Series.
Boy, howdy. So let's get into those first two matches. You open up the show with Terry Boy, who gets a special U.S. flag umbrella that he's very excited about, against Masato Yakushiji. Terry Boy wins with an abdominal stretch in just under 9 minutes and 30 seconds. It's okay, but it's not great.
No, that is the apt way to describe this. I will say, I'm curious to figure out when Masato Yakushiji becomes the man that we would know and love, because it's not happening yet. We've seen him, I think this is the third time we've seen him, and he's your basic Japanese young boy at this point. I am curious to see when the heroic underdog babyface version of him kicks in.
Right, and we'll get into other things he's doing on this show, and I think maybe this is like kind of the delineation point of when he is Masato Yakushiji versus his other character that he plays for a little bit, because it does really feel like that he starts 94 still as the bottom person on the roster and just kind of treated like a young boy. The grappling here was fine. Terry as kind of the veteran is a little interesting with how he kind of plays it, but this is kind of a nothing match.
Yeah, veteran by default here, because Yakushiji, like you said, is the lowest and youngest guy on the roster at this point.
Right, and speaking about lowest members on the roster, Tacha Michinoku defeats Nihiro Hoshikawa in 6 minutes with a stranglehold. A little better from the first match. It does kind of feel a little samey, where you had a lot of groundwork grappling between Terry and Yakushiji. That's Hoshikawa's deal. And if you have an opener that is so leans on that, it's going to make your second match, where you see it happen right again, feel a lot less effective.
I do like that this is the first sort of glimpse we've seen of Taka, a guy that would later work extensively in battle arts and in pro wrestling, Fujiwara Gumi. I think there's an overarching theme here that I've tried to hit on of like, hey, I don't think people realize Taka Michinoku was as good as he was. I also don't think people realize that he was as capable of a grappler as he was. I think by and large think of Taka doing the step up plancha to the floor and that sort of thing and being in the six man tags. Taka at one point was a very accomplished grappler and a great technical wrestler. And this is not that version of Taka, but it's the first we've seen of that version of Taka.
And the crowd appreciates it. Like, the crowd gets really up for the crab hold that goes on with it. And I found myself liking Taka doing this stuff more than what we were seeing from him in 93, to be honest.
Yeah, because it's a little... he's... In 1993, I think he's doing stuff that he's not quite ready for. You know, it's a little sloppy. And here, there's a simplistic nature about this match that I just think really works for his skill level at the time.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. And Hoshikawa is the guy to do that against on this roster, especially if Hanzo Nakajima is not around. It makes sense why Taka would do this kind of match with him.
Yes, I agree. Fun undercard match.
What was not fun was Wellington Wilkins Jr. versus Yone Genjin. This went to a double countout after 3 crowd brawls, including the final one where a push cart was used to kind of drive Yone Genjin into the crowd. And we get that this match is a touchstone and that the Wilkins comedy versus Genjin is an act that they keep on going to. And it is very, very over. But under modern eyes, this outstays its welcome immediately.
I mean, it's one of the worst matches that I feel like I've watched in quite some time. It's certainly the worst thing that I've seen in Michinoku Pro. It's the type of thing that immediately makes me dread watching any more Yone Genjin matches and any more Wilkins matches as well. I mean, there's nothing redeeming about a match like this. I'm not sure who this is for or why this would be popular, but it felt like it lasted an hour and it was never good for 1 second.
Yeah, and it's also like the fact that I do think we need to say 30 years ago, this is wild shit happening. Like, this kind of brawl in Japan is wild and it's reacted as such. It's just, you know, just takes forever. Like, Yone Genjin grabs a bicycle and then acts like he doesn't know how to use it.
that there's a whole sequence where he tries to escape and hide by a space heater, and then they start brawling again. They go outside and around. It's just we've seen these two guys do these brawls already, and it's just kind of there, and it cuts down on a card that very very quickly steps up right after this match.
Yeah, trust me, I don't need to bury a match that's 31 years old too deep. The Wilkins thing is so fascinating because he's in Michinoku Pro forever. You know, as long as we're going to talk about Michinoku Pro, he's there. And I'm just not sure, like, I don't want to say I'm just not sure why, but it's just sort of one of those things where, you know, from here until the end of time, he's just going to wrestle Yone Genjin. And I can't believe they never found either a better use for him, or they ever said, we don't need you anymore. The fact that he's just so locked into this promotion, but from my knowledge, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe something will surprise us as we get into 95 and 96, but he's just there taking space on the undercard, never doing anything productive. I hope I'm wrong. I hope he's involved in a six man where he's unbelievable and he jumps out and surprises me, but I don't believe that's ever going to happen.
Yeah, and at this point, I feel like, other than kind of being that presence, that I do think it's important to have touchstones throughout this. I mean, we've seen it throughout Dragon System history, how we evaluate people a little bit higher because of, like, the touchstone element. It's like, oh, yeah, no, Sakura Chikawa, you know, not only was he, like, the greatest comedy wrestler of all time, but, you know, when he got in the ring and it was actually, like, in context, like, a serious thing, he was actually quite good. I'm waiting to be able to have that way to defend Wellington Wilkins Jr. It's just not happening.
Yes, I think that's very well said.
The semi-main event, we get to see a new person, Case. We have not seen them. We've seen them at ringside, but we've not necessarily seen them in the ring. It is Monkey Magic, and he is the newest member of the Delphin Corps, and he is teaming with Super Delphin. Monkey Magic, of course, now we could say Masato Yakushiji, doing a lot more than the baby, than the undercard rookie gimmick. He still is the bottom person in Delphin Corps, but Monkey Magic teams with Super Delphin against Shiryu and Leon Guerrero, who is our good friend Superboy, under a mask and in an outfit that's supposed to emulate Shiryu's.
I have to ask you now, because you mentioned this on the last episode, that you were waiting for Shiryu to be good. Mike, March 31st, 1994, is Shiryu finally good in your eyes?
He's composed. But, you know, I think that he gets the team with a Swiss Army knife of a luchador against a charisma beast and Delphin and an absolute rookie that he can throw around a little bit and has to, like, eat his offense. But do I think Shiryu is good? No. Do I think he's composed now and does not look out of place in this semi-main event? Yes.
I like him. I think he is a fun, sort of plucky wrestler, and I think his chemistry with Delphin in this match was a delight. I'm ready to see more of Shiryu, actually.
I just, like, I loved, like, later day Kaz Hayashi, and I'm just ready for him to get to the point. Like, I know it happens before 1996, but we'll keep on keeping Trap Case until Shiryu kind of turns on in my mind.
By the way, how great is it that Delphin, who now we're in 1 year plus of him being this maniacal heel in Michinoku Pro, how great is it that he now has an underling that is directly ripping the character that he began his career as?
Oh, it's perfect. Yeah. I mean, the only thing that would be better is if you gave him Monkey Magic Wakita 2, you know, or Monkey Magic Wakita Jr., the Hyodo Monkey Magic Wakita. But it's such a good kind of position for Yakushiji. He's still very, very green, but it's not one-to-one, but I like now seeing places, and we've seen in modern day of Himare, of taking, like, talented rookies and kind of putting them in other positions. And I think that he is he's a bit of a goober in this character, but it is nice to see Yakushiji does have, like, you see the flashes of brilliance from him in this match, much more so than the opener against Terry Boy.
We'll definitely see him one more time. He's going to be on the next Michinoku Pro show that we review. After that, I'm looking at his cage match here. It's very, very sparse for Monkey Magic going forward. We might not ever see him again, but I like this gimmick. I like the concept. And I kind of am wishing that maybe we would have done more with this. I'm just very entertained by this idea.
And it's worth noting on this show and at least through the March tour, Sato shaves his hair and he's gone. We do not see Sato whatsoever. So you have, like, this is such a small roster show. So having someone like Yakushiji being able to work twice on the show really kind of hides that very well.
That's a great point. Maybe that's why I did not like this show that much, is that Sato is not on it. And man, can you feel that?
Yeah, no, Sato will be, he goes bye-bye for a little bit. Does he? Yeah, Sato, yeah, he will be back before Oda Ward. But
thank God, that's the next show we talk about. And thank God he's going to be there.
Oh, I'm already looking at his match at Oda Ward, and I'm here for it.
Yeah, no, very much so. Very much so.
But the other person that I think is pretty notable that we didn't get to see on this show, and a lack of him on at least in early 1994, we talked about him up top as a Rookie of the Year candidate in 1993. There's no Wally Yamaguchi, Mr. Toyota, whatsoever in early 94.
That is a major mistake. You know, I don't know if he ever comes back, but I also don't know what this is. See, this is where my research fails me. If he's not a Michinoku, I don't know what he would have been doing, but that's another guy where it's like, man, you know, Delphin and Shinzaki are doing very well on their own, but they're better with him in their corner and his in their corner.
Yeah. And at least one could say when you talk about like Wally Yamaguchi, he has his legit job at Weekly Gonk too, which was still very, very kind of busy at that point. I mean, even though, you know, he had so many fingers in the pots in 1993, this was not all that he was doing at that time. So I think it's very likely in 1994, like he works for WAR too. So maybe there's a little bit of that as well.
That's true.
But I thought it was kind of notable there with this. Shiryu gets a good moonsault press on Monkey Magic to win this match. And the most fun thing about this show, like my favorite moment of it, Shiryu and Leon Guerrero steal what is a gift to Super Delphin. And Superboy takes a drink of it and takes a bump on the floor because he is a genius. He is my favorite now at this point.
Oh, man, this is look, I'll go ahead and say it now. This is, I think, the weakest show that we've watched from start to finish thus far. But there's still room for Superboy greatness. And that I love to see.
But what was great, Case? The main event, Jinsei Shinzaki versus Great Sasuke, goes to a double KO. The crowd starts booing vociferously as we get to see now Sasuke and Shinzaki match up 1-1, and we get to see how Sasuke is able to stack up against a guy who essentially has been untouchable in Michinoku Pro in this point, and the superpowered Jinsei Shinzaki.
I am so curious to know what you think about this match, because to me this was one, it was a very good match, with Sasuke being a good wrestler and Jinsei Shinzaki being a great wrestler. And I thought there was a noticeable talent gap between the two of them.
But I think that talent gap is actually kind of important with these two and in the way that they portray themselves in the ring, though.
How, like, so?
It is Shinzaki having, like, the fact that he, up until this point and really outside the FMW match, he's been basically, you know, unbeatable. Like, he is treated as someone that is just like tearing through everyone. And how can someone who we've talked about vociferously be as uniquely human as Great Sasuke and take on someone with like the superpower pilgrim energy that Jinsei Shinzaki has? How do you do that? By being reckless as fuck and just throwing your body at the guy. And I love the fact that that's how Sasuke decided to try to take down the pilgrim.
I'm with you there. I think all of that works. What I really think this match shines is in the last 5 minutes. And I knew...
Oh, the powerbomb that explodes the table?
So, you're exactly. It starts even just a minute before that. Sasuke goes for a cape rana. Shinzaki catches him, puts him in a tombstone. Goes for the diving headbutt. 2 count. They roll out to the floor. At that point, Shinzaki hits a powerbomb on the table. The table explodes. Just an absolutely outstanding spot. And then everything from there, I'm really locked in on, because Sasuke makes a great comeback. He does the Asai moonsault to the floor. We're doing this whole great thing. It's awesome. What's great is the first double down they do when they're back in the ring after Shinzaki's beat him down, after Sasuke's made his comeback. this is such a minute thing, but it really jumped out to me. The first double down they do, Ted Tanabe is the referee.
And he's great in this.
He's so great in this match. There is this thing that I think is largely absent from American wrestling, and I don't know why that is, but it's the thing in Dragon of like, hey, you know, it's referee's discretion because we don't want to end a main event in 2 minutes and send everybody home upset. Like, there's always that angle of refereeing that I like in Japan. And Tanabe here, when he does the double 10 count, he is counting so aggressively and so loudly in this attempt to get both of these guys off the mat. And it really does add an element of intensity to this match that I don't think just a hot crowd would have been able to do. Like, it is the referee that really takes this match up a level. And then from there, you know, they do the dueling dropkick, they do the lariat, and from there, you know, it's a double count out, whatever. It's a good match for the first 15 minutes. It's a great match for the last seven. It is a testament to Shinzaki, who through 1 year of Michinoku Pro footage has been a much better wrestler than I ever realized. And it's Sasuke doing kind of what we know Sasuke to do. And it's a great dynamic that these two have.
Yeah. And lo and behold, this would become the major feud of the promotion throughout at least early 1994. And at least from like where we saw Sasuke in 93, where it did feel like a lot of it was him and his presence up against your Delphins in July, or later on, like with going up against Mr. Pogo, right? And what you really get to have here is what happens when someone is like really just like working off of their charisma, their presence, and then now you have someone who's able to match that. And at least with Sasuke, I find myself enjoying him in this match almost as much, if not more, than the feud he had with Dolphin over last summer.
Yeah, oh my god. I mean, I think he and Shinzaki are better opponents than Sasuke and Dolphin are.
Easily. And I went 4 on this. I thought that this was on a show that really was missing something, and you got to have a solid semi-main event. This match is the one thing to go out of your way to go see on the show. I liked this more than the mask versus hair match in Osaka. I think it's the best match we have this episode by far.
Even better than the Korakuen six man.
I wasn't as high. I was 3.75 on the Korakuen six man.
Wow. Okay. That's so. I was going to go down my star ratings here.
Okay.
I would go 4.5 on the six man. I would go 3.5 on the match in Osaka, and I would go 3.75 here.
Okay. So I was 3.75 Osaka. I was at 3.5, and then I was 4 flat here.
This main event's really good. It was way better than I was expecting it to be, because as I said when we first started doing this, you know, oddly enough, two of my bigger Michinoku blind spots are Shinzaki and Sasuke, because there are two guys that have never totally jumped out to me. I like Sasuke in a confined six-man tag, and Shinzaki, I was always under the impression, was kind of a stiff who didn't do much, but I was wrong. I mean, these guys have great chemistry. This match is really, really good, and I've really enjoyed Jinsei Shinzaki in 1993 and 1994.
Well, buddy, we're going to get to revisit this match in episode 6.
We are indeed. Episode 5, actually. That is where we're going next, because this is episode 4. At least I think I'm right about that.
No, this is episode 4. I thought episode 5 we had something. Yeah, we're good.
Episode 5, we're doing both. We're going to tackle the Super J Cup, and we're going to tackle Michinoku Pro, April 29th, 1994, the rematch between Sasuke and Shinzaki, coming mere weeks after Great Sasuke takes the entire wrestling world by storm.
Yeah, you get to see Sasuke at a new level, and Jinsei Shinzaki try to attempt his 88th temple, and we'll talk about that on episode 5. Case, did you have other things you want to touch on in this episode of Those Days?
I do not. I am looking forward to the next episode when we are back in the driver's seat of some excellent pro wrestling.
Yeah, and a little bit of bad news, Case. There is a false count anywhere, a Wellington Wilkins Jr. versus Yone Genjin match on April 29th. Just prepare yourself.
That is devastating to hear.
But guess who's coming back?
Who's that?
Kendo's back.
Ah, I love Kendo. All right, I'm good. I'm set. I'm looking forward to it.
All we need is Kendo. All we need is Kendo. But that's going to do it for this edition of Those Days. You could follow us on social media personally. Case is on Twitter at _InYourCase. I'm at Fuji Heya. If you would like to follow Open the Voice Gate on social media, we're at Open Voice Gate on both Twitter and Blue Sky. If you want to join in the conversation, get the direct links for the matches that we talk about today. The best place to do that will be the Voices of Wrestling Discord in the Open the Voice Gate channel. We post all of our show lists. We post all of our match listings there. And usually, this time we announce it a little bit more in advance, but usually that's when you will, where you will find out when the next episode of Those Days will be coming. But Case, the next time everyone's going to hear about us, it's going to be a pretty big departure from Those Days, as Dragon Gate's going to be in Vegas this week coming up as we're recording this, right before WrestleMania weekend 2025.
Yes, I cannot wait. We'll have plenty of coverage of that, obviously, on this podcast feed.
Yep, and that is going to do it for this edition of Those Days. Thanks to everyone for listening in the kind notes. We'll be back with you next time talking about Super J Cup 94 and the Wado Burns Tokyo Oda War Gymnasium show for Michinoku Pro and the main event, Jinsei Shinzaki versus Great Sasuke. Take care, everyone. Bye.
Hello, Voices of Wrestling listener, Dave Ryan here. Have you ever wondered to yourself, how many hidden gems are hidden away inside the last years of World Championship Wrestling? Have you ever asked yourself how many tenuous gags can be made about the name Mike Enos? And have you ever thought about what it sounds like for two Irishmen to interpret a very chaotic company through its B-show? The answers to all this and more are just a click away. Check out Days of Thunder every second Thursday on the Voices of Wrestling podcast network.
This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.